Welcome, everyone, to this Webster Support Technical Exchange session. Today's topic is Channel Framework Part 2, Common Issues Debugging and Trace Analysis. Today's presenters are Ashish Godasura, Chris Meyer, and Jackson Leonard. Ashish has been with the WebSphere Application Server Technical Support Team for the last 10 years. In this capacity, he has supported customers for many different component areas, such as Channel Framework, Web Container, Session Manager, and Security Component. He is a subject matter expert in the area of Channel Framework, Web Container, JSP, and Session Manager components. Chris has been with the WebSphere Application Server Channel Framework Level 3 team for several years, and his capacity has provided defect and how-to support for many customers in the area of Channel Framework and network communication. He is expert in the area of debugging, trace analysis of channel framework issues, and packet trace analysis. Jackson is with the WebSphere Application Server Technical Support Team. In this capacity, he has supported customers for many different component areas, such as Channel Framework, Web Container, Session Manager, and Security Component. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Chris. Chris, you may begin.
Thank you, David. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. And welcome back to all of you who may have joined yesterday for our first part of this presentation. So, David, would you mind switching over to the next slide, please? Thank you. So we're going to go ahead and get started for our agenda today. We're going to talk about TCP channels AIO and NIO. We're going to talk about channel framework must gather information, as well as common problems, specifically timeouts and IO return codes. I'll also go over some trace analysis. And then after that point, I'll turn it over to Ashish, who will take you through plug-in trace basics, Wireshark tool for IP tracing, and then useful filter for TCP connection filtering, as well as reviewing IP trace for connections. Go ahead and go to the next slide. We'll go to slide 3. Thank you. So the first thing we'll go over is TCP channel AIO and NIO. And the big question I'm sure everybody has is, what are they? AIO and NIO are two different ways that TCP channel executes IO operations, so reads, writes, connects, closes, etc. The first one, AIO, which is the default from 6.1, is the native library for each platform. So Windows has a different implementation, Linux has a different implementation, Solaris, etc. They all have different implementations, and it's a WebSphere-specific library. NIO is the TCP channel's implementation of the JDK NIO, and what that is it's a specific JDK implementation. It goes straight Java. There's no other implementation there. The question is, what benefits do they provide? In general, AIO is scaled better than our implementation of NIO, and what that really means is more connections at a faster pace. Now, the next question that I'm sure lots of people have seen is, why would I ever want to disable AIO? And generally, we suggest you don't disable AIO except for Solaris. The reason being is Solaris has historically had problems with us. They've got changing APIs, so we just decided to disable it. And as you can see, for PK88455, we changed the default to NIO, so AIO is still available on Solaris, it's just it is not enabled by default. And that APAR went into 707 and 610.29 going forward. Another misconception we have is that AIO is asynchronous and NIO is not synchronous. So when you disable AIO, you go into NIO, you become synchronous. So that is not the case. They can operate in both ways. They can operate both in asynchronous mode. What matters is what's calling us. So whoever, for example, on the server side, you have the web container that would call us, and there's a property you can set which will set us into synchronous mode when we're writing. So David, can you please pass this on to slide 4? So the next thing we'll go into is the must-gather information, and as you can see on the slide, a link has been provided for the must-gather for the channel framework and WebSphere application server. The trace string that we have set is HTTP channel equals all, HTTP channel equals all, TCP channel equals all, and generic DNF equals all. HTTP channel covers everything to do with HTTP channel, processing the request and response, calls going up to web container, coming back from web container. TCP channel covers all of our I/O. So reads, writes, connects, closes, anything to deal with that comes through TCP channels. Generic DNF deals with anything that has to do with headers. So parsing headers, reading headers, getting headers, anything to deal with headers, generic DNF covers. One important note is TCP channel must be taken statically, which means it must be taken on the restart. If it's not taken statically, not all the information will come through and it won't be as useful. One thing we have found while going through debugging with different customers who are unable to start, you know, who can't do restarts very often, is they can turn on the tracing, restart the server, and then after the startup, they can turn the tracing off, and while it doesn't turn it all off, it does turn some, most of it off, so it'll be more of a minimal trace spec. This reduces the amount of downtime that has to happen, if, especially if the server isn't allowed to be restarted. Go ahead and go to slide 5. These are links for the plugin must gather and IP traces, and these are traces that are related to related to the channel framework that will be useful in debugging problems. So the first link is a link to the HTTP plugin must gather. The next one is using packet traces and Snoop, TCP dump, Wireshark, etc. And then the last link is a link to the tool for Wireshark, which is what we use for viewing IP traces and using it for debug. And these three things Ashish will show you a little later on. Let's advance to slide 6. Now we're going to get into the real meat of this presentation, which is the common problems. So for channel framework, we really have two main common problems, and that's timeouts, which are async operation timeouts, and then the second thing is I/O return codes. So let's first cover timeouts. So what it is just an operation timed out. What that means is we sent a read out. The read data never came back, so we issue a timeout saying that there was a problem with the read. TCP channel traces will help you find how long the delay is before the timeout, as well as the time for the delay. So when you set TCP channel tracing, it will display the IP trace, or the IP, the port numbers for both the remote and host port, and then from there you can find out how long the delay was, how long the timeout should have been, et cetera. And we'll show you examples of this later. And for this sort of problem, tuning the read timeout or write timeout may help, but there could be performance implications with that, and there's no guarantee that it's not going to work. You know, if something's timing out and it's never getting any data, turning it up to 30 seconds, or you know, from 30 seconds to say a minute, might not make any difference. Next type of common problem that I mentioned is I/O return codes, and an example of this is provided, which would be async I/O operation failed, reason RC:32. There is no process to read the data written to a pipe. And all that really means is the connection has been closed and we believe it's still open. So how this might happen is we write a response out, and when we go to do the persist read, the client may have closed the connection. So when we do the persist read, we'll get this sort of exception, just close the connection. As I mentioned, we'll look at both of these, an example of both of these problems. In order to fix an I/O return code, you really need to understand what's at the other end of the connection and what's going on. So, for example, you might want to find out why the client is actually closing. Is it an error, or is it just closing it because it doesn't want to, you know, work with the connection? When we advance to slide 7, so the first problem we see is timeouts. And there's four different types of timeouts. There's read timeout, write timeout, persist timeout, and connect timeout. And all a timeout means is an I/O operation was executed and hasn't received a response for a certain amount of time. As I mentioned before, an example of this is a read is executed. Say we're reading for the response data or for the body data. No data arrives from the client within the 60-second timeout. This will trigger the timeout exception and will return back up to the application saying there is no data to no data shipped out. Timeouts can come in many different flavors, many different ways. A few of them are shown here. You see a socket timeout exception, or the next one down is an async operation timed out, or an error occurred while parsing parameters. All this sort of stuff is the same thing. It just means the socket timed out and we didn't get any data. As I mentioned, this is just two examples of what a read timeout could look like. The root of the issue is still a socket timeout exception. And most of the time, the exception will be a socket timeout, async operation timed out. Sometimes you might find something different. Advance to slide 8. The other type of problem is an I/O return code. So an I/O return code is a result in I/O operation. So technically, I/O operations always return with a return code. The difference being is that they're not all error return codes. What it is the OS is trying to give us some information. The big thing here is different OSs will return different things. So an RC64 on Windows might mean one thing, whereas on Linux it's something different. And each operating system has a different set of return codes. And there's a few of our common ones here, the RC64, 76, and 32. In general, they all mean the same thing. It just means the other side of the connection closes the connection while we still think we can use it. As I mentioned, an example here is we read the request from the client, and then when we attempt to read the body, we receive the RC32 indicating the client closed the connection. So in that particular scenario, we want to look at why the client closes the connection after it send the request. Both timeouts and IO return codes require TCP channel equals all set from the start of the server, and IO return codes usually need IP traces to prove that the exception, why the exception happened. Most all the time, the end result of the investigation is why the other side closed it, and this, you know, there's various reasons. A client might close it because it needs to. There may be a firewall in between, and various different reasons for that. Let's go to slide 9. The next thing we're going to take you through is a quick trace analysis of a timeout and IO return code. It's not the full trace, is all it is. We ran an example that Ashish did, and then we pulled out those traces and went through the analysis. So let's advance to slide 10. The first thing we'll go through is a timeout. First trace analysis we'll go through is a timeout. And what we did is the reported issue was a web services exception. So the first thing we want to do is find the exception. As you can see in step 1, we find the exception, and the example of the trace is here for the exception. We see that the nested exception is web services exception, socket timeout exception, async operation timeout. So we know we're dealing with a timeout. Now we'll go to slide 11. So the next step we need to do is find the actual exception that was dealt with. So what we saw before was the web service exception that was printed out when it received the exception. So now we really need to find the root of the socket timeout exception from the channel framework. So we follow the thread to find the initial exception, and in this case you can see it was exception while reading response, socket timeout, which is the same thing as the nested exception we saw before. So knowing it's a timeout, we can set TCP channel equals all from the start of the server, find out what the trace is doing, and we also know from these traces that this was an outbound reading response, which only ends. We know that the connection is outbound, and it's because we're reading the response. And the outbound, aside from being HTTP outbound, as you can see in the trace statement, the only people that read for responses are outbound connections. We'll never read from a response from inbound connection. Advance to slide 12. So step 3 is we'll want to follow the connection to follow the connection which we received the timeout. So after looking up the thread and finding in step 2 the exception, we also were able to find this trace statement, which details the local IP address as well as the port and the remote IP address as well as the port. So using this information, we can track the whole connection throughout the entire set of traces. Knowing this is an outbound connection, we'll want to use the local port to trace through all to trace the connection. So we'll take the local port 49205 and search for all occurrences within the trace, and that'll give us the total readout of the connection. So we'll go to slide 13. So once we search through that, we'll have a whole list of all the operations, as I mentioned, and we'll see that there would be a socket close, which is the one we saw before, and then before it, we'll have seen the read synchronous, which is what we're seeing here. So using the local port, we were able to find this resynchronous, and we see that this is the failing operation. And then if we follow that thread up just a few lines, we can see two important pieces of information. We see why we were reading, and we can see the timeout of the read. So if we advance to slide 14. And slide 14 shows us steps 5 and 6, which are why the operation... the operation we were attempting that failed. So we can see we were trying to read synchronously for the response. And step 6 tells us what the timeout is set to, and specifically we know that we're doing a read and we're doing it for 300,000 milliseconds. So this timeout is a millisecond, so we know we're reading for at least one byte for 5 minutes. So the important part to remember is that trace statement is in milliseconds, not in seconds. So when we translate that over, it turns into 5 minutes. Go to slide 15. So after all this, What we know now is when the exception happened, what we were doing that caused the exception, and the connection we were communicating over. These are all very important information, they're pieces of information. And the other piece to remember is this is from the WAS perspective. This isn't from the client, this isn't from plugin, this isn't from anybody. This is just from the WAS perspective. So we know from a WAS perspective why the exception happened, what connection it happened on, and what we were doing at the time. The next steps in this investigation is to look at the other side of the connection and why it didn't send any data. IP trace can be helpful to prove that the data wasn't sent, but not the important part to remember is an IP trace will show that it wasn't sent, not why it was sent or why it wasn't sent. So it'd be important to get traces from the other side, be it plugin or whatever the client is. We'll go ahead and advance to slide 16. So this slide is a quick rundown of all the steps. First step is find the reported exception. Second step is follow the thread up to find the initial exception, which, as I said, this is just all the steps that we went through before. Step three is around when the initial exception, there should be a statement indicating when the connection we were using that encountered the timeout. Step four is we use the port to grab the trace. And the important thing to remember is do not grab the thread ID. We want to take the remote port because connections can span multiple threads. And that's the nature of asynchronous is if something goes asynchronous, another thread can pick up where that thread left off and continue doing work. And the last step is using data from step four, we can find out the operation that counted the timeout and why we were doing it. So when we advance to slide 17, just to go back real quick, what we just looked at was a timeout, how to go through and look at a timeout and find out from a WAS perspective what happened, the connection it happened on, and what was going on. Now we'll go through an I/O return code trace analysis. So the first thing we want to do is find the reported exception. And in this case, it was an I/O exception. You can see the trace statement here, which has I/O exception, async, I/O operation failed, RC107, transport endpoint is not connected. So what we know from this that we need TCP channel equals all set from the starter to server and an IP trace. So let's advance to slide 18. So the first thing we want to do is follow the thread down from that IO exception to find out where we closed the socket. The reason being is this is the most reliable way of finding out the remote and local port. And just as we went through before, this trace statements have the remote and local IP address and the ports. So this gives us the connection that the problem occurred on. And using the remote port here, because this is inbound, we'll search on all the occurrences of the I/O operations. So when we advance to slide 19. So in step three, we'll use the port from the previous step to find the first operation before the exception occurred. So we'll use the remote port, knowing that this is inbound, we will use port 51422. We'll search on all occurrences of that, and that will give us, again, a readout of the entire connection. And as I mentioned before, the previous one was the timeout was an outbound, and we know this is inbound. And when it's outbound, we'll use the local port to search because the local port is the dynamic port, it will be unique. And for outbound, you're connecting to a static port, which might be 5060 or whatever it is. For inbound, the static port is local because that's what everybody's connecting on. The remote port will be whatever they're connecting or have the connection. So for inbound, we'll want to grab the remote port. For step four, we'll follow the thread up a few lines and find out why we were attempting the operation. So in step three, we found the operation that was failing. So we know it was a read synchronous on the local port and the remote ports. Then we'll follow the thread up a few lines, and we find out that we're trying to do a get request body buffer, so we're trying to get the request body. We know this request is, as I mentioned before, we know the request is inbound because it says HTTP inbound, as well as we'll never read for request body buffer unless you're inbound. Go ahead and advance to slide 20. So continuing on, step five is filter on the remote port from the WebSphere logs using the time of the exception. So we know what we'll basically be doing is taking the remote port from the WebSphere log and filtering on the IP trace. This is where the IP trace comes in. Doing that, we'll get a readout of all the connections that happen from the packet level. Using the time of the exception, we can see 10.15.32. We will look at the IP trace and find out where in the IP trace the exception might have happened. So generally, we're looking for a FIN or reset or something like that. And as you can see from the trace statement that we have here, a FINAC was issued just before we did that read and the IO exception token. So for step six, from the previous step, we know the other side of the connection closed the connection with a FIN, which is what caused the channel framework IO exception. And with this knowledge, we know we need to look at the other side of the connection to find out why it closed the connection. So let's advance to slide 21. So basically, in conclusion, what this is again, another kind of cheat sheet, quick being able to look at how to look at an IO return code. So the first step is find the reported exception. In general, this is usually an IO exception. Step two is follow the thread down to the socket close statement. From there, we're able to find the remote port or local port, whichever is in this case, and search on that port from step two, step three, and then that'll show all the operations in the trace. And then in step four, we follow the thread up from the previous operation. So in this case, it was the read. We'll follow the thread up and find out why we were doing the read, which in this case was for the body. Step five, we'll use the same port that we found from the previous steps and filter the IP trace, and later on Ashish will show you how to do that. And that'll give us a full readout at the packet level. And then using the IP trace, we look at the connection, find out when everything was sent, and then look for whatever packet was failing, or causing the failure, which in general is the reset or a FIN. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ashish, who's going to take you through some other debugging aspects of the channel framework.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much. Let's take a quick pause and quickly run through what Chris has taken us through so far. So initially, we discussed, Chris explained us the two different main terminology that we use with the channel framework is AIO and NIO. And he explained us that what that two means, AIO meaning implementation of WebSphere, to do the IO, and NIO is the inbuilt implementation of the Java. And by default, is always the AIO is turned on, and there are many situations that you might think, let's turn it on, turn off the AIO and go back to the NIO, but he just clarified that the best thing is AIO scales more better than NIO, and you must have the good reasons to turn it off. So we looked at that. He also clarified that by default it's turned off. AIO is turned off in Solaris at that for some reason. And later on, we also went through the two common issues that, and only two common issues. Like you, any issues with the channel framework, you can able to classify in these two categories. Either you are having the timeouts, or either you are having the IO return codes, meaning the connection issues. The connection died from other side somehow. So Chris took us step by step and how he approached both of these kind of issues with the detailed step involved. So let's move on to the next slide, number 22. So now moving forward, we will actually touch on the same both of these categories, which is pretty much similar steps involved. What we did it is we built a production-like environment, kind of production-like environment. We three machines involved. We built the environment, three machines involved here. And the first machine is a client browser, which is happened to be in Raleigh, in my ThinkPad that I used. And the plugin machine that we configured is in Austin with the Jackson. And again, I have another machine which is running the WebSphere application server 70013 in the Raleigh. So we kind of used the three different physical machines to mimic the production-like environment with the three different IP addresses involved, as you can see there. So in this environment, in this particular environment, when the request sends from the browser and response get back, there is two connections involved. You know, first connection is from client browser to the HTTP server or plugin, which is listening on port 80. So port number is fixed there because that's what the port is available and it's listening to. And the next connection is the plugin opens the connection with the application server. which plugin opens the connection on the dynamic port and opens to the TCP port, which is 9087. And those who joined yesterday's presentation, that's the same environment that we use. So as you can remember, the TCP port for the unsecured communication, which is HTTP communication, is set to 9087 for this machine. So let's. So this is the environment, and to mimic the connection error, what we did is we wrote a very simple JSP, just a two-line involved. We named it as a long-running request.jsp. The only line there is thread.slip. We made that thread slip for 2 minutes to just simulate that my request is taking long time processing. And by the time, simulated that the plugin waited enough and it timed out somehow based on some parameters, and we'll look into the details. We will look at the traces. We captured the trace, TCP trace and MustGather, as Chris mentioned before, on the last machine, which is 35 at the WebSphere application server side. We also took the IP tracing on that machine, and then we also took the plugin log tracing on the plugin tracing 172. So we'll look into that entire connection in detail. So let's move on to the slide number 23. Okay, so with that diagram, that test environment in hand, as we already discussed, there are two, when we know the request flow from the browser to the HTTP server and to the WebSphere application servers, and the response flows back on the same connection to the other way. So there are, in the whole request flow, as we discussed, there are two connections involved. And connection is from 9.27.162.225. That is my browser machine. The XXX is the dynamic port that will open on fly. And it connect with the plugin machines, and we'll just mention the last digit in IP in the IP address, which is 172 on port 80. Browser will send entire request to the plugin. Then once the request is received at plugin at 172 machine, it opens the another dynamic port to the application server. In our case, the application server machine is 35, listening on 9087. So that's the second connection. It sends the request back and reads the response back on the same connection, sends the response back on the same connection. Now, this is the one of the important parameters. There are many parameters at the plugin. Around the area of connections means during the connection time, there is a setting some parameters. One of the important parameter I wanted to bring to your attention is server I/O timeout, which is at the plugin side. By default, it is set to 60 seconds. What it means is after plugin sends the request to the application server, it waits for this much time. In a hope to get the response back. If it doesn't receive the response back, it times out, and it tries one more time to the same application server on the new connection. It opens the new connection. It tries to send the next request, same request, to see if it successfully receives between 60 seconds. And if it fails in second attempt as well, then it sends the 500 back to the client. So I really want to point this out, this parameter, because by default it's 60, and what we try to mimic in this test environment is make the application server run more than a minute. In this case, it's 2 minutes. So there will be a server I/O timeout, and plugin will think that I'm not receiving a response on time and closing the connection to mimic the connection issues. So let's move on to the slide number 24. All right, so starting first, step number one, when we get the connection error, we request the MustGather, this is the first thing we do is to make sure the traces has been captured statically. As Chris mentioned, if this tracing, especially from entire this tracing, the TCP channel all requires the restart. If it is not taken with the server restart, we don't have good information captured. It will not report any reads And basically, you know, we don't have the good picture. So first step first, we make sure that, okay, it's taken from the server startup. The few key points that we can find is server startup log, and see if the current thread specification is set to what we need. We also look at the thread, if we see the startup thread, in this case, 000, and we look for some key things like server is started for open for e-business and things like that to make sure the trace is taken from the startup. Let's move on to the slide number 25. All right, so we make sure that we have right tracing captured and that connection error has been captured. So we already know which exception we are getting in the system out and the traces, right? So in the second step, we directly jump to that exception. So in this case, we are getting the asynchronous I/O operation, reason code RC55. The specific network resource or driver is no longer available. So we first jump to our main error message at the WebSphere site to start investigation. Now, in this step, and only this time, you kind of rely on the thread ID. In this case, it's a 2A. So when you find your find your error message into the trace, only this time, just go on that particular thread a little bit down until you find your connection. And when I say connection, the second line, as you can see, that demonstrate what the connection is, which involves local, double colon, your machine name, which is local meaning the WebSphere application server, right? In this case, it's ashishwork/IP address 279.27.162.35 on port number 9087, and follows by remote jacksontest.austin.ibm.com. That's the another machine it's talking to on this connection, which happens to be the plugin machine, and its IP address 941.133.172. And this is the dynamic port I was talking about that the plugin opened with us, 59697. So this entire string is going to be very important for me to debug this issue. So in this step, the whole goal is to find that connection string. So it starts with the local and ends with the dynamic port of the plugin. Let's move on to the next slide, 26. So now, by this time, we have we know on which connection our error is occurring. So in this step, we will now search for the entire connection for this trace string. So basically, I grabbed this string and searched in entire trace, not on the on the same thread, because as Chris previously mentioned, and as you can see here, when I issued this search on this string on the entire trace, I find this many lines, and as you can see, the trace the thread ID are different. You know, there is in this one connection, which is pretty much just one request is being sent, there is three threads handle this connection. Starts from 06, then a thread 2D involved, and then 2A involved. So especially into the channel framework issues, we never rely on pulling the threads and things. We just pull the connection, not the thread. So in this case, when we pull the connection, let's read how the connection happened. So the first line in the thread 06 issued the read on the connection. On the second thread happened to end up reading the request. In this case, it read 788 bytes of the request body. Then we write is issued, and we end up wrote with the capital wrote 379 bytes of the response body. And after that, we issued another read right away. And that read we'll explain later, which is for the persistent request. So we did send the response back, but now on this connection, we are just keeping it open via this rate for the purchase timeout, which is 30 seconds by default. And when we did that, we realized that another side of the connection, I cannot wait on that connection because, you know, there is no connection exists. And we reported the error message, RC55, specific network resource or driver is no longer available. So this is what happened on this connection and how this connection can be we can read. So let's go to the slide number 27. Okay, so we will come back to that, what we were tracking that particular request. Right now, let's talk about, because we start talking about the persistency, so a couple of slides regarding how the persistent request would look like. So this is an example. This is actually not the three requests. There are more than three requests being sent on the same connection within a persist timeout. And this is how it should look like. So when I pull that connection, as you can see, in the first set of greens I handle the one request at nearly time 10:34. And as you can see, the first read is executed, and then we end up reading 771 bytes of request body. Then we process that request, and we wrote 10,296 bytes of response back to the back on that connection, and then we executed a read. That last read in the green is for persistency, to make that connection persistent. So we are keeping open in the hope that the same person or same browser will send me the another request. And it within nearly how much 6 seconds, as you can see, from 10:34:41 I got the next request in 10:34:47, which is within 30 seconds. So I end up reading another request on the same connection. In this case, this request happens to be 778 bytes, and I processed it at the application server side. He wrote 2,457 bytes of response back, and I again executed the last read to make it persistent. The third request has been received within 11 seconds or so. As you can see, after 10:34:47 to 10:34:58, the next request has been read, and so on. Here, the last line should be, colored differently, because that's the fourth request is getting started there after a few seconds there. So just to give you an idea that when you pull the connection, not necessarily that you are going to have that just one last request having a connection, but it might have the history of other requests being handled on that connection. Okay, let's move on to the slide number 28. Thank you. This is how the persist connection timeout occurs. I mean, this is again around the area of discussion of persist connection. So in this example, we just sent one request of Snoop and haven't sent anything else within 30 seconds. So as you can see and read in this connection, we read the request of 771, and then we right away send the response of 10,155 bytes back. And then we executed the read right away on 10:11:30 time frame. To make it persistent. So we waited nearly 30 seconds, as you can see here. After 30 seconds, we never received any response request on the same connection. So on 12:03, we just reported I/O exception while doing I/O on that, meaning that read, we are ending that last read. There is no error involved here, just an I/O exception. We are just reporting that we are closing this connection. And the last two statements saying that socket channel is closing and this connection is now being closed because there is no more request on this connection. So just to also getting familiarized with how the persistent connection getting closed in event when there is no more request coming on that connection. Let's move on to the slide number 29. Excuse me. Now, the persistency is turned on by default, as we discussed yesterday, but you can turn it off. And what happens and how it looks like when you don't have persistent connection. So we turn it off, we send a request for the snoop, and this is what it looks like in the trace when you pull that connection. So again, the same story. We executed the read first, we read the request body, and we wrote the response back to the browser. But as you can see, right after sending a response body, we are done. We test, and based on the settings, we don't want to turn on to keep this connection alive. So immediately, we start start executing the closing of connection, as you can see. And within the same time, we close the connection, and that's the end of that connection. So when the persistency is turned off, you will see that every request will have its own connection, basically. So let's move on to the slide number 30. Okay. So now we'll pick up from the trace that we have been looking into the slide 26 before, for the long-running JSP, long-running requester JSP, where we send a request, we read the request on some time frame, and then we by the time we are ready and write the response, it was 2 minutes, and we got the error message RC55 at the app server side that, hey, something was wrong on that connection. So now we are checking on the other side of the connection. In this case, it's a plugin trace. So here is our original trace string into that slide 26. The connection was from machine 35, 9087. To the remote, which is the plugin machine 172.59.69.7, which is the port they opened with us for this particular connection. So, one of the points I would like to mention is when we take this example, you know, there was not a easy way to pull the connection into the plugin, but by now, right now, we have already have the feature enhancement into the plugin trace, where the same port number 59697 will be is reporting right now. So before that, we used to just track the connection using the request URL and the time frame. So that's what I did it here. But now and in future, it's more easier just to use 59697 port to find that connection into the plugin trace. So again, coming back to the point, we kind of figured out that this is the request being sent at during the same time to this machine on 9:35:21. Again, the timestamp is a little different because of the time zone. The plugin machine is in Austin, 1 hour late than what we have noticed into the app server machine, which is in the Eastern time zone, which is the time's there at 10:35, and here you see the time as 9:35, just to clarify that. So as you can see in red, plugin has sent a request to the application server at 9:35:21. And right there, after sending a request, waiting for receiving the response. It waited for 1 minute, as you can see, from 9:35 to 9:36. And right there, after 1 minute, he hasn't received any response. So it, as you can see, it's closing the connection right there. So now we can figure it out. That when we looked at the other end's log, that what happened on that connection, other end of connection has closed the connection due to the server IO timeout, basically. So let's move on to the slide number 31. All right, so here is another fun part of getting more details about what happened on that connection. So on the same transaction, we captured the IP tracing at the application server side. We ran the IP tracing during when we are taking all this request. We load that IP trace into the Wireshark, and this is how it looks like. As you can see, it's lots of lines. The scroll bar on the right-hand side has a very little, as you can imagine, because IP trace is, you know, it captures all each and every individual packets on going from that Ethernet connection. So when you load it, it looks scary. But let's move on to the slide number 32. We'll explain how to make it simple. Okay, thank you, David. So in the slide number 32, we will discuss about the filter that we can use into the Wireshark tool to make to only display the activity which we want to interest in. So as we know, the connection we are interested in is this, the first line, as you can see, 35.90.87.172, which is plug-in machine, 59.69.7. So we have this information already. This is the only filter equation that, you know, if you remember, it's fine. And it's not complicated as it looks. It only involves two key keywords, ip.addr, IP address, and tcp.port. That's it. First bracket is just a combination of both the IP address involved, in this case, app server IP address and the plugin machine's IP address, separated by AND word. And in the second parenthesis, both the ports involved, 9087, which is WebSphere's port, with the plugin's port, which is the dynamic port that they opened with us. And we just make this both the information gather with the AND word. So as you can see in the next bullet, this is the filter equation that we built. So IP address of first IP address equals 927.162.35, which is the application server machine, and IP address equals 941.133.172, which is a plugin machine in our case, and TCP port equals 9087, which is application server port, and TCP port equals 59697, which is a plugin port. So this is our equation for the IP trace. So let's go to the slide number 33, please. What we did here is we copied that filter equation, put it into the Wireshark right there into the green, hit the enter button, and as you can see, that million line disappeared and just this many lines comes in. This is what we are interested in only. What happened on that connection? So this is all the activity happened on that connection. And it's very easy to read. So let's go line by line and read what each and individual line means. Let's go to the slide number 34, please. It explains the same story, but in the IP trace language. So here, the first three packets between plugin and app server shows the connection is established. So the first line, as you can see, the machine 172 started the communication, which is the plugin machine. It sends the it started the initiation of the connection. It sends the sync packet to the app server machine, in that case 35. The app server machine 35, when it receives the sync package, it again sends the sync ACK packet back to the plugin machine, and plugin machine acknowledged that yes, I got it. And this, with these three lines of, you know, three packets here and there, the connection is established between the plugin and application server machine. The next line after the connection is established, the next two lines demonstrate the data being sent from the plugin machine. So as you can see, the fourth line is 172 sends 235, which is application server machine, push ACK package with the length 788. So we know the plugin sent 788 worth of data, in this case is an HTTP request to the application server, and right away application server said that, yep, I got it by ACK package. Now, look at the timestamp. So at the this happens, the request is sent on 10:36. Now, moving forward to the third bullet, plugin did not get any response for our application server in 60 seconds. So what it did after 60 seconds, as you can see, has a timestamp, 10:37:34, it waited enough as per the server IO timeout, and plugin machine 172 sends the packet FENEC to the server machine 35 that, hey, I'm done. I'm just giving you, telling you that I am in the closed wait state. So I'm saying when the FENEC meaning is, you know, I am, you can, the connection is still open in closed wait state, but I, you can send me anything that you want, but I'm not listening on this one. And next, on the next very line, the application server says that, yep, I got it. This happens on the operating system and the network layer, that, okay, I got your FENEC. But we still didn't know. At the application server level, we don't still know that what happened at the network layer. Now, moving on, after 1 more minute, total 2 minutes, because we simulated the 2 minute wait, we are done processing the request, and we, meaning application server 35, starts resending the response back on 172 on the same connection as with the PUSHEC. It sends the response body of 379, but after the pushing back, it realized that, oh, there is a, this connection is under the closed wait state. So immediately it responds back to the FENEC again into the next packet. And that, after that, the final closing will happen in the last two lines as a reset ACK and the reset. So, again, just wanted to show how the how we can track the connections. You know, start from the application server tracing from TCP channel all and HTTP channel all and BNF all trace from where we can grab the connection. Using that connection, we can find the very valuable information about what might have wrong onto that connection. We can go to the other end and find out why the connection being closed from the other end, and we can even look at the IP trace for more details at the packet level to see what activities happen on that connection. So let's move on to the slide number 35. Thank you. So basically, that's what we discussed today. So we started with TCP channel AIO and NIO concept. Chris mentioned what they are and why you don't need to turn off AIO. Many times, you know, people think like, okay, for some reasons, out of memory or things like that, let's turn off the AIO, but really not good reasons to do that. We looked at the channel framework must gather documents, what we need to debug any connections or IO error messages. Then Chris took us to the two common and only two classification of the channel framework. Either it's a timeout or it's a connection error or a return code, we can say. Then we discussed about the test environment. You know, we kind of mimic the production-like environment and mimic the connection error. We went from step one to five to, you know, figuring out on which connection the error is occurring, why the error occurred, and went to the other end, reviewed the documents, and also reviewed the IP tracing. So let's go to the slide number 36, please. So this is the additional information about the WebSphere application server product and resources for your information. So please feel free to go there to explore more. With that, I wanted to turn over to David. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Chris and Ashish, for a great presentation. And finally, don't forget to connect with us. You can be notified about upcoming webcasts related to the product and topics discussed today by subscribing to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange mailing list. Simply send an email to wsehelp@us.ibm.com with the subject WSTE subscribe to get a list of mailing lists. Also, if there is a topic you would like to see scheduled or if you have any comments that would help us improve our future webcasts, please let us know at that same email address. You could also connect with us through our Facebook page and our Twitter account. Talk to us and let us know how we can make this program even better for you. We welcome any ideas that you may have. Thanks again for your participation. At this time, Don, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Yes, at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1. To withdraw your request at any time, you may press star, then 2. And looks like our first question will come from Yu Choi Young. Your line is open.
Hey, Ashish, thank you for the presentation. My question is, okay, in order to see the ports in the channel framework trace, do I need to enable the TCP channel, or will the HTTP channel show the ports?
Thank you, Yuju, for the question. I think you need a TCP channel in order to see the port. You can see, if you might have attended yesterday's, but the port information, that's the configuration of TCP, not the HTTP.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
The next question comes from Bindu Gera. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thanks, Ashish, for your presentation. My question is when you look into the application server, application, when it is throwing like a 500 error because of the channel framework is not functioning properly. So first we normally look into the HTTP server, right? So after making sure that the HTTP is up and running, still, you think because of the channel framework issue, we need to be troubleshooting the channel framework until unless, that 500 error goes away?
Bindu, thank you for your question. When you get the 500 error, so you are really seeing at the client perspective that you are getting some kind of error on your browser, right?
Yeah.
So from the admin side, what I would do first is to check our logs, application server logs, because 500 can be sent from plugin itself, as we discussed in one of the slides, that if plugin is not able to get the response in certain time, it can also set 500 and send back. So I would, as an admin, I would first check application server logs to find out the reasons for that 500. If I don't find there, I would find at the plugin tracing to see plugin logs to see if the plugin is involved in that. But if you find the exception stack, then that exception stack, it will tell you if it is a channel framework component or some other issues. Means if you see the timeouts or connection issues, then you can conclude that, okay, this 500 may be due to the channel framework component, or it may be due to some other reasons, from other application throwing some exceptions or something like that. Hope that answers your question.
That answered my question. Thank you, Ashish. When we look into the log files and see there is a channel framework issue going on, so what is the right steps for the troubleshooting it, looking into the port and making sure it's available like that?
Right. So from the without, I think your question is when you conclude if it is a channel framework related exception, then what I would do is, I know my next other side of the connection. Most of the time it's plugin, not necessarily in your environment. You might have something else. Means there are customers that I've seen has a load balancer in between plugin and application server. So in that case, the load balancer might be your other end that you need to check to see if you find some errors or why that connection is being closed or something like that.
Okay.
So, I would go to the other end, not necessarily plugin. It may be very well the plugin in most cases, but based on your environment, I would go to that next end of that connection to find out more.
Okay, got it. Yeah, we'll look into the connections with the help of the telnet or on. So, okay, thank you, Ashish.
Yeah, thanks.
The next question comes from Steve Reed. Your line is open.
Hi, Ashish and Chris. Great presentation. Thank you very much. In the presentation, you talked about some timeouts on the plugin side, server I/O timeout. There's also other timeouts that can be configured there. And you talked about the persistent timeout in WebSphere. Are there any guidelines or recommendations that customers should be aware of for tuning both sides, the persistent timeout in WebSphere compared to, let's say, the server I/O timeout in the plugin, so that they will work together correctly?
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for your question and a very good comment. We have the individual documentation on what the WebSphere has to offer, and actually we did cover all the configuration part yesterday in very detail. And as you know, there is a great documentation from plugin side. There is not a direct correlation between persistent timeout and the server I/O timeout, because persistent timeout is, timing out after sending a response back, because we are trying to persist that connection after sending a response back, while server I/O timeout at the plugin side is during that request, that after I send a request, I'm going to wait for this much minutes. But I get your point. I get your point there is how to make these two configurations more meaningful together. And I never come across, kind of a total solution or total tuning guide, considering all the connections parameters available at plugin and what we have to offer from the connect channel framework. So that's a good question, but I never come across that tuning kind of guide so far.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
The next question comes from Arun Kumar. Your line is open.
When you were analyzing the Wireshark logs, you specified that the plugin will wait for the first 60 seconds, and if you don't get a response within 16 seconds, the connection will go stale. But initially, you said that it will wait for the first 60 seconds, and then again it will retry again for 60 seconds, and then it will give a 500 error. So, which one is which statement is correct?
Hey, thank you, Arun, for that's a great question, and actually both. From the plugin side, I send for this continuing with this example, right? The plugin opened the first connection on that port of 59697, I believe, on that port, right? And it waited. Plugin waited for 1 minute, and then the plugin is at the upper level, not the network level. So, plugin from its side, it says, I'm not waiting on this connection anymore. And just, I'm not listening anymore, and then it moved on. And plugin might have opened the new connection to the application server and sent that same request on that new connection. But that previous connection is still there. Only thing is plugin is moved on, and it's not even listening to that connection. And that connection is now being handled at the very lower level at the network layer. What it means at the application server side, we are still working on the first request, right? We still don't know what has happened if the FNAC is already received by a network layer, because we are at the application upper level still processing the request, and by the time we are done, even we pushed out the response by, then we realize, there is a FNAC on this connection, and we report that RC55 on that connection. So, if both the things are true in this case. Hope that answers your question. If not, please let me know.
In the first scenario, let's say it has received the FNAC as it has not responded in the first 60 seconds. And what if the application server responds after 60 seconds? So the response will not be received by the the response will not be sent back to the plugin, right?
Actually, that's a very good question, and that's the area of, the gray area kind of you can think of, where the application layer kind of disconnect from the network layer, and there is no very good way of doing that. Me and Chris discussed about this to make it how to make it more useful. As you can see in the same examples that we covered, right?
Yes.
We know that that connection we already received. The application server did receive the FNAC on the network layer in 1 minute, after 1 minute of waiting. But application server at the application server side, and that we know from the network layer because we are looking at the IP tracing at the very lower level. And again, it goes back to the yesterday's presentation when Jackson, described all the logical layers. IP trace is really at the very bottom level, what we are tracing. At the TCP level, which is the transport layer, that's where the application server really knows about it, right?
Right.
So that's where we slightly disconnect. And your question is exactly on that point, application server machine network did receive PNAC, but application server process never. It doesn't know about it. Even after 2 minutes we are done, it did because that connection is not closed. It's in a closed wait state. That's a terminology that network expert knows better. That closed wait is not closed connection. It's still open from the application server side. It's still open. It's there. So it did boost all the response bytes on the same after 2 minutes because connection is still in the closed wait state. What it had end up happening at the plugin side, that machine might have just got it and discarded it. It doesn't care about that data. But right after when we start try to do the persistent read on that connection, we realize that, okay, this connection, whatever we are trying to read on that connection is bad connection. I cannot read on the closed wait. And then we reported RC55. So going back to your question, yes, there is a disconnect. So in this particular scenario, at the application server side, we know that my persistent attempt is in the error. So that must be there is my previous data might not have received it by the other end. That's the conclusion we can derive. But your question is right. Means it's there is a little disconnect between network layer and the application layer. I hope it's clear. But if not, please reiterate.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm clear on that.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks, Ashish.
And I'm showing no further questions in the queue.
Thank you. I believe Jackson has some questions in the group chat that he would like to address. Jackson and Chris.
Hey, thanks, David. Yeah, there were 3 questions that I saw that Jackson did not cover or went unanswered in the chat. The first one was from Jim, and he asked, which protocol is used to for communication between Webster application server and MQ? And I believe it's just straight HTTP. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert on the MQ server, but I'm fairly certain it's straight HTTP, and that's how that's built. The next question comes from Adrian. It says, if a WAS JVM is doing a particularly long transaction, which would be greater than the server IO timeout, is there a way to get the application server to send keep alive back to the plugin until it completes? Unfortunately, as far as I know, there is no ability to do that between the plugin and WebSphere. They don't communicate in that manner, so it's kind of dumb at that point. I believe we have other products that do that. I think some things like the ODR do that. I'm not totally sure, but I know the plugin does not do that. And another question that Adrian had is, if a JVM crashes, does the OS send a reset on the connection back to the plugin? And I believe that's the case. I'm not totally certain. I believe if the JVM crashes, it kills the processes associated with reading, and it does notify it and sends a reset. I've personally never encountered it, so I don't know. Ashish, do you know?
No, I'm not clear on that. So it's a very good question. We can go back on that.
Yeah, I think it does because when you look at it, for example, if a server is operating and taking requests and then to kind of simulate a crash, you might just shut the server down. I think it does send resets or something along those lines. So I believe so, but I think we can do a little more research on that.
So, Adrian, if you don't mind sending an email to me or Chris on that, we will definitely get you find out and get the answer for that.
And David just sent it. Just changed the slide. Those are our 2 emails.
Thanks, Adrian. So did we miss any other questions?
No, I believe those are the 3. Oh, wait, there is one more from James. He says, is there a way to stop the plugin from resending the request to App Server after the first request failed? Yes, there is a way. I believe it's a configuration option, and I believe, if I remember correctly, that configuration option is actually disabled by default. But again, this is plug-in area. This is not either of our either Ashish or mine or Jackson's expertise. But yes, if you look at the plugin documentation, there should be a configuration option and how to configure the retries and whatnot.
Right, that's correct. And I know YouTube and Steve, if you know the answer, you please feel free to jump in from the plugin side to see if you can answer that question. But yes, I believe there is a way. By default, it's tried two times and then finally sends the 500, but that might be the way to do only one time as well.
And with that, those are the last questions from the chat.
Okay, thank you. Don, do we have any more questions on the phone?
Yes, the next one comes from Steve Reed. Your line is open.
Yeah, just to follow up on that question about the plugin, usually the requests that you don't want to be transmitted are post requests. And so by setting the plugin parameter of post buffer size, set that to zero, it prevents the plugin from retransmitting post requests. In addition, starting in FixPack 7.0.0.27 and 8.0.0.5, there is a new feature in the plugin called Server IO Timeout Retry. This is a new feature, a new parameter that we've never had before, but it can be used to configure how many times will be allowed to retry after a Server IO timeout. And you can actually disable that so that the plugin will not retry after a Server IO timeout has occurred. So those are the two different ways that you can control that. But the most common is plugin is the post buffer size equals zero.
Thank you, Stu. Thanks for jumping in.
And I'm showing no further questions in the queue.
Thank you. At this time, we will conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation and hope you'll join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Chris and Ashish, for presenting today, and thank you, Jackson, for monitoring the questions in the group chat.